my concern is that where is the guaranteed savings? And I don't see it.
Lawmakers react to proposed state budget cuts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 15th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Fairbanks hardware store packs up after more than a century.
You could go to Seattle, you couldn't find any store that had as much of a selection as Samson's did.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
Governor Sarah Palin wants to shrink state government spending by 7% next year. She released her proposed budget for fiscal year 2010 this morning. State spending on infrastructure projects would be cut in half under Palin's budget, but an increase in federal funds would allow the state's capital budget to fall by only 5%. Total funding for running the state's day-to-day operations would drop by 2.5%, and spending to inflation-proof the Alaska Permanent Fund would drop by more than $500 million, or 58%. While the federal government is in the process of dramatically expanding its budget in order to bail out Wall Street, Governor Palin's proposed budget would return money to the state's rainy day fund. She's proposed to deposit $388 million into the state's constitutional budget reserve. Palin says while plummeting oil prices have hurt the state's budget, Alaska isn't doing as poorly as the rest of the country.
It's not a rainy day. It's not pouring down rain. It's sprinkling. And the price of a barrel of oil, still, if we would have looked at $40, $42 a barrel a couple of years ago, we would have looked at this price and said, good, that's healthy. That's relatively high compared to some years. But compared to the 140 that we were blessed with many months ago, the 40-some dollars a barrel looks relatively low.
The state budget assumes oil will sell at just over $74 a barrel. That's nearly twice today's price for North Slope crude. Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin says oil prices are so volatile that the state may not wait until March to update its revenue forecast. The U.S. Energy Information Administration announced last week it expects global oil consumption to fall by 50,000 barrels a day this year and 450 barrels a day in 2009. The EIA says that would mark the first time in 30 years that oil consumption has fallen 2 years in a row. While that may be good news for anyone concerned about greenhouse gas emissions, it's bad news for a state whose government gets 90% of its revenue from oil production. Democratic Senator Kim Elton of Juneau says Alaska doesn't need to talk about boosting spending to stimulate the economy just yet.
We've had huge construction budgets, capital spending budgets, over the last couple of years. And there is a lot in the pipe that is going to be creating jobs for Alaskans.
Elton says he'd want to examine the assumptions that go into Palin's budget before evaluating it. But he praised the expanded funding of Head Start school programs for low-income children and expansion of the Denali Kid Care program to cover more children. It will take lawmakers and community leaders time to comb through the governor's budget plan, but some had skimmed through summaries today. Alaska Municipal League Director Kathy Wasserman says at $60 million, the proposed municipal revenue sharing money is the same as the last budget, although originally the governor had proposed $75 million last year and the legislature cut it to $60. She says in 1986, revenue sharing was $141 million.
So we thought, 20 years later, inflation, whatever, we didn't think we were asking for anything illogical to ask for $75 million when it used to be $141 million when, 22 years ago, actually. And I realize oil has dropped again, but back then oil was much, much lower than it is now.
Democrat Beth Gertula says House Democrats are supportive of municipal revenue sharing, and she thinks there should be more after a decade of cuts.
That's a level that I think personally I'd like to see continue to go higher because the municipalities have continued to bear the bigger burden, you know, when you look at the ratios. But that's something that getting into session, we'll have to see if we can swing support for that or not. But the Democratic caucus in the House has always been very supportive of seeing good, strong municipal revenue sharing.
Kurtula says it's important to try to stimulate the economy, but still work towards saving money for the future. She thinks renewable energy will help do that by providing cheaper power to communities, which in turn helps promote economic growth. She says whether or not a 7% reduction in the budget makes sense depends on where the cuts are made. She says going through the detail when lawmakers get together again may reveal some savings in consolidation of services and overhead, but she feels strongly about no cuts to certain programs.
If you're talking the Office of Children's Services, if you're talking health and safety issues where they're, you know, some of those programs still have not received really the full increases they needed, then those are going to be the areas where I would be arguing against seeing any kind of a across-the-board cut.
Republican Representative Carl Gatto says a 7% cut is probably not enough because lawmakers tend to add more to the budget when they go through it. Gatto says he'd like to see the idea of consolidating all the savings accounts, using a percent of market value each year to run government, and protecting the bulk of it from spending, possibly raised again in the upcoming session. The plan was defeated last session by lawmakers who wanted to access the funds if necessary. But Gatto says he's concerned about the gap that will come in the future between oil revenue and possible income from gas.
So that we can continue to spend. Most of us are better at spending our own money than giving it to the government to spend. So my concern is that where is the guaranteed savings? And I don't see it.
Like Kurtula, Gatto likes the idea of renewable energy, and he was happy to see $50 million in the budget for it. Gatto says he also thinks revenue sharing is a good way for local governments to make appropriate decisions about what their communities need rather than having it mandated from the state. Federal investigators in Alaska are awaiting results of laboratory tests to determine what kind of accelerant was used in a fire that heavily damaged Governor Palin's home church. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says the accelerant was poured at several locations around the exterior of the church, including entrances. Possible accelerants include gasoline, kerosene, diesel fuel, even lamp oil. The blaze was set at the main entrance of the Wasilla Bible Church on Friday evening, while a small group, including two children, were inside. No one was injured. Palin was not at the church at the time of the fire. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a proposal that would encourage historical tourism in Sitka.
We have an unbelievable opportunity to make this cultural and heritage tourism a destination. Why people will come.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
And by
the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau. Anchorage is wild about winter. You can find winter event information and plan your next Anchorage adventure online at anchorage.net/stay.
Backers hope a new charitable giving program will help Alaska service groups hit hard by the nation's economic downturn. But its proceeds will not make it into nonprofit groups' coffers until later next year. The Pick, Click, Give program stems from legislation introduced by a Southeast lawmaker. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The idea behind the new program is simple enough. Give Alaskans a chance to donate part of their permanent fund dividends to the charity of their choice. All people have to do is file for their PFDs online, designate the donation amount, and the group it will go to. Brenda Hewitt is director of the United Way of Southeast, which hopes to benefit from the program.
I think the fact that it's easy is going to be really helpful. So when you're getting that nice surplus money back, you can think about taking some of that funding and putting it back into the community that has provided so much for each one of us.
The program is called Pick, Click, Give, and it's being promoted by a group called the Alaska Giving Coalition. Chairman Jim Candarola says it's based on research showing an untapped potential in the state.
Unfortunately, Alaskans generally give on average less than our counterparts in the other 49 states. And then the number of Alaskans who actually make charitable contributions, also generally less of us contribute than would be the average across the United States.
It took legislation to create the program. Haines Republican Representative Bill Thomas authored the bill.
Hopefully we'll see it'll be successful. And I think that the commitment that Rasmussen has put in there, I think will surely make it worthwhile because they've been a great giver in the district and throughout the state.
Thomas's measure gives the program a three-year run. It will need legislative reauthorization to continue. Many social service agencies nationwide have reported a drop in donations. Some Alaska groups say the economic downturn has had less impact here, but groups that provide direct services, such as food banks and homeless shelters, report seeing more clients since the recession hit. Candarola of the Giving Coalition says the new program could fill some gaps, but not right now.
It's not going to help this year because the program really doesn't take effect until the 2009 dividend program, which begins with the application process in January. But we hope that this will assist, you know, a year from now, those organizations to not just supplement what they're doing, but hopefully grow and make available more resources.
The Checkoff program includes about 330 nonprofit organizations. Candarola expects more to sign up in future years. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Sitka Historical Society has asked the Assembly to double its financial support for the organization. The Society's municipal funding this year is $53,000. The Society would like to see that boosted to $120,000 annually. Historical Society board members and the Assembly met in a work session last week to discuss the issue. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Even at $120,000, the bump in funding would keep Sitka in the lowest tier of community support for historic preservation statewide. Cordova and Nome contribute $160,000 and $190,000 respectively to their historical museums. Juneau funnels $270,000 in local funding to museums. Ketchikan, $570,000. Local board member Doris Bailey said that the Sitka Historical Society had won a major organizational grant from the state's largest philanthropy, the Rasmussen Foundation, but the award was on hold. Bailey said that the Rasmussen consultant, Ira Perman, did not consider Sitka's museum viable at current levels of local support.
His opinion is that the present city allocation and society budgeting is not sustainable for the society and museum to meet its existing mission and duties. Therefore, his decision is that without city and borough support, they will not fund the $60,000 and will not be interested in any future grant requests from this society.
Sitka Historical Museum Director Bob Mettinger said that last year's rush to assemble a historical repository at Sheldon Jackson Stratton Library was premature. He said the heat of high oil prices and the urgency of the college's closure drew too much energy to the repository project, which he now believes will require several years to complete. In the meantime, Mettinger told Assembly members that Sitka is underfunding an important facet of its visitor economy.
Cultural and heritage tourism is the one effort within the tourism industry that is absolutely exploding. Tourism in America is the third highest income generator of all. And within this town, within this place, we have an unbelievable opportunity from the Tlingit, from the Russian, into our era of the forestry, the commercial fishing, on through SJ, all of these pieces and parts to absolutely promote this location through a partnership with all of these agencies to make this cultural and heritage tourism a destination why people will come.
In a memo, Mettinger and the board proposed boosting the Sitka Historical Museum's budget with revenue from the statewide passenger vessel services fee, also known as the cruise ship head tax. Sitka's share last year was about $2 million. The Sitka Tourism Commission is actively soliciting proposals for the funding, which must have direct benefits to cruise visitors as well as indirect benefits to local residents. Besides leveraging the Rasmussen grant, the Historical Society's $120,000 request would create a full-time administrator. Mary Miller, superintendent of Sitka National Historical Park, saw that position as critical to planning for a new facility that could serve the park, the Historical Society, the proposed repository, and the tribe.
So my point is that it's happened for Sitka in the past, and I believe it can happen again. But there needs to be support and there needs to be planning. And that, I believe, is part of the request that's before you, is to free up some human resources to line these ducks up so that we can create a better Sitka.
Miller said the Park Service was acquiring 3 acres of the former Sheldon Jackson campus that could be a suitable construction site. The Assembly took no action on the Historical Society's request for a budget increase. The Assembly will begin its annual budget process next spring. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Fairbanks has said a temporary goodbye to a local retail institution. Samson's Hardware closed the doors at a location it had occupied for 104 years on Friday. The store on the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, which is currently owned by the Jakovich family, has survived in the modern era of big box retailers as the place to get hard-to-find items and personalized service. Longtime employee Ann Schuyler says Samson's is unlike any other store.
We're the only place in town other than a bar that you can belly on up to the counter and put your foot on a foot rail and make yourself at home. They come in and they tell you, I want to go from my fuel tank all the way to my furnace. Or I'm drilling a well. Or I'm building a log home. Or I'm putting in a wood stove. Or I gotta do this or that. And the old saying is, we may not have what you want, but we have what you need.
Schuyler says Samson's maintains relationships with suppliers of parts and tools unique to frontier living.
Galvanized wash tubs with ringers, rapid washers, food mills, marlin spikes, FIDs. Some of our suppliers only make some of these products once a year. The rapid washer, for instance, which is a cone-shaped thing with a stick, and you plunge it up and down in your laundry. And they make that once a year.
Schuyler says Samson's has shipped such items to locations as far off as Antarctica, but locals are the store's mainstay. Ed Busby has lived in Fairbanks since 1946. He says he has had an account at Samson's since he was 23 years old and has relied on the store for unusual items.
You could come in here and get stuff, horse harness, anything you can imagine, and you could go to Seattle, you couldn't find any store that had as much of a selection as Samson's did.
People like Busby stocked up at Samson's Hardware in recent weeks as the store will be closed for about 6 months. It's being forced from its longtime location to make way for overhaul of the city's main thoroughfare. Schuyler says Samson's should be open in a similarly vintage building by next summer.
Hopefully, on the property that the family owns, about 200 feet to the back in the old NC Dominion warehouse that's about 100 years old, too.
Schuyler says the State Department of Transportation wants Samson's out of its current building by January 15th. She says everything will be put into storage while the new location is ready to accommodate the iconic hardware store. She says many of the old store's historic fixtures, including the counter and a collection of antique hardware, will be moved to the new building.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act is a federal law that requires museums and federal agencies to return human remains and other cultural items to their descendants. That means it's up to people like U.S. Fish and Wildlife archaeologist Debbie Corbett to locate all of the remains that were taken off federal lands in Alaska, identify who they belong to, and try to get them home. But Corbett says the process isn't always straightforward for the dozens of remains she handles each year. The archaeologists and others who remove the bones, mostly during the 1930s and 40s, didn't always do it carefully.
they're grabbing a bag full of bones that may or may not belong to one person. There may be two people mixed in. There may be three people mixed in. They may all belong to one person. So what we did was we got all these fragments together in one place, and we looked at them as a group to see if we could kind of reassemble individuals.
Corbett says she looks at the bone sizes and markings to determine if they were from females or male, youth or adults. Some bones show scars from arthritis. Others show where muscles were twisted and pulled for rowing kayaks or sewing baskets.
So it's a pretty interesting picture of kind of daily life.
Some of the recent NAGPRA claims are from bones removed from burial caves in the islands of the Four Mountains. The remains cannot be returned to the caves because they are not secure. Corbett says many times modern native groups aren't sure what to do with ancient remains.
You know, putting them in a Christian cemetery may not be appropriate because they may not have been Christian. So they're still internally trying to figure out what is appropriate for these remains.
For other Aleuts, the answer is much clearer. Remains originally removed from Agatu Island in the Near Island group are buried by the Aleut Corporation in a special graveyard on nearby Shimya Island. Aleut Corporation representative Melvin Smith says they wanted to return the remains to the area and bury them with respect.
Sometimes we've brought out the priest. We've taken Father Peter out with us a couple different times, and then other times I've gone out there myself with either our president, and you know we just did a burial, you know, and put up a cross and whatnot, just to marking the grave.
A new NAGPRA claim has recently been issued for remains from T.P. Banks' collection for an individual found on Agatu in 1949. The U.S. Forest Service has won a court decision in a lawsuit over a proposed timber sale on northern Kuprianov Island near Petersburg. A federal judge ruled last month that the agency's planning for the Scott Peak project complied with the law. The suit had originally been filed by a Forest Service biologist who passed away early this year. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
In his 25-page decision, U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein ruled that the Forest Service did not violate NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, when it planned the Scott Peak timber sale. Tongass Supervisor Forrest Cole says in terms of NEPA, the ruling means the agency can go forward with the project, but he says the plan still needs some work.
The issue that's been out there since day one is that Scott Peak timber sale, as it is a deficit timber sale, and we had not had a plan to go forward with this prior to or pending the outcome of this case. So what we're going to do is look at the current situation with Scott Peak, probably reanalyze it given the current market conditions, and see if anything has changed, and if not, see if we have some other abilities to incorporate it into other projects.
The judge also ruled against a claim that the Forest Service had violated the Appeals Reform Act. Under the laws, the Forest Service has to give other government officials and the public an adequate chance to review and comment on proposed policies and plans like timber sales. The agency has to take a hard look at the environmental issues that are raised and respond to concerns. Public appeals over the impacts to wildlife habitat prompted the regional forester to reverse the agency's original approval of the Scott Peak project. After more review of the plan's impacts, Cole approved it again and dismissed additional appeals. Cole says he was not surprised that the federal judge sided with the agency.
I was pretty confident that the work that we had done on the project through NEPA and then the rescinding of the original decision, the reanalyzation that the district had done, would facilitate what we discussed with the complainant, and after it was reissued, I was fairly confident that the issues that had been raised had been dealt with.
The lawsuit had been filed by Glenn Eath, a Forest Service biologist who passed away unexpectedly in early March. While leading an agency team that reviewed the Scott Peak plans, Eath authored a draft report that was critical of its potential impacts on wildlife habitat. After his superiors removed him from the project, Eath raised his concerns through the agency's public appeals process and finally in court. His wife Marquetta took over as plaintiff after his death. She declined comment for this story. Eath charged that the Forest Service had violated NEPA because it did not disclose or address issues he had raised in that draft report, a report, Eath argued, that was part of the public record. But in last month's ruling, the court sided with the Forest Service's position that the document was internal and deliberative. Andy Stahl disagrees with the judge's ruling. He directs the watchdog group Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. Stahl points out the fact that Eath had already provided the draft report to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, a separate public agency, for review.
The state has very distinct interests from the Forest Service. It owns the wildlife. The Forest Service does not. It is often on the other side on issues against the Forest Service. It's an independent government agency. It's not simply a hired paid consultant, as the judge analogized in his decision. So I think that the court simply got that wrong.
The Forest Service still faces some pending litigation related to this issue. Prior to his death, the agency had investigated and subsequently suspended Eath from his job. Eath believed it was retaliation for his whistleblower activities. This fall, Marquetta Eath filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit seeking documents on that issue. Also, the Scott Peak Project is one of the sales named in a suit filed by Greenpeace and the Cascadia Wildlands Project in July. That suit is still in its early stages, and it challenges the U.S. Forest Service's methods for evaluating habitat for deer on the Tongass National Forest. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The Yukon Quest pleads its case for a portion of local bed tax money before the Fairbanks City Council tonight. Race organizers missed the application deadline for the money this fall. Fairbanks Mayor Terry Sturl says the quest is an important event, but that giving one organization special treatment could throw the whole funding process into question.
It does, you know, bring up that, you know, that question of fairness, because over the weekend I had an opportunity to talk to a friend that's involved with an organization in town, and I said, geez, I didn't see them on the bed tax list, and he said, well, we missed the deadline. So, you know, people may not have applied because they missed the deadline. So it's a Pandora's box we'll be opening if we choose to open it.
Mayor Sturl offered a proposal earlier this year to eliminate the funding application process for five groups, including the Yukon Quest, that regularly receive a portion of city bed tax revenue. Quest Director Tanya Simpson says she was under the perception the proposal, which was shot down by the council, had been approved. Simpson says the money is important, but the race will happen even without it. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just pick, click, give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition. The strongest voices in the community, business, and government can be heard each Tuesday on APRN's Talk of Alaska. Get your message out by becoming an APRN program sponsor. Details at 907-550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.